Good evening, Erev Tov. Welcome to Torah Tuesday this week of Parashat Vayechel. Before we get started, I just want to make you aware that we do have the brochures for the Israel tour. There are some up here. If you want to pick one up after class or some of the coffee pot out there. Also, if you go on the website that's listed for you on the top of your handouts, there's a link on there that says Israel tour. And it's downloadable as well as a description of the tour and all of that. That's, if you want to forward it to anyone or think anyone would be interested, just let them go to that website and there will be information for that. For many of you who weren't here the last time we met, there was a surprise Mem party. All right, Mem is the Hebrew word, or letter that means 40. So there was a 40th birthday party for me, and you graciously provided a way for me to get to Israel. And so it's looking out like I'll be able to be there for Passover. And so that should be exciting, and we'll keep everyone updated with that and be able to spend some time with Rabbi Abraham while I'm there, as well as some other acquaintances that I have in the Holy City. So let us begin with the blessing before the study of Torah. And also let us bind our souls to our Messiah, and so that they will be elevated and our understanding will ascend with His. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Asher Kidishanu Bo Mishpita Vetzivanu Le'esoch B'Divrei Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with His commandments and has commanded us to be engaged with the words of Torah. Hareini Machasher Atzmi Ba'adon Yeshua HaMashiach HaZadik Shehu lechem ha'chaim v'ha'or ha'amiti. Mapsi teshuat olamim l'kol shamav. We hereby join ourselves to the Master, Yeshua the Messiah, the Righteous One, who is the bread of life and the true light, the source of eternal salvation for all who hear Him. Amen. All right, if you haven't done so, please do grab a sheet at the end of the table. Help you follow along. Parashat Vayechel. It's a Hebrew word that's coming from the verb that means to assemble. That opening verse, Exodus 35, verse 1, is the opening verse of the parashat, and it goes through Exodus 38, verse 20. Vayechel is coming from that verb that means to assemble, so when Moses assembles. But as we're going to see this evening, it actually is the root for what we call church. And so we're going to spend some time talking about that because it's very important. It's so often followers of Yeshua in the church never imagine themselves to be anti-Semitic or to be anti-Israel or to be replacement theologians, but we've inherited it. And part of that comes from only knowing the English and not knowing where our English words are coming from. And that some of our translators have indeed purposely misled us. So we're going to highlight that this evening and give you some eyes to see and so that you can begin to unpack this for yourself. Our Hebrew lesson is going to build on that. It's coming from the apostolic writings, as all our lessons have in the Shadows of the Messiah course. This is coming from Colossians chapter 1, verse 18. Shaul, writing this, and it's just three words in Hebrew, but it gives us a verbal tally to a key word we're going to discuss this evening. So it reads, Hu Rosh Ha'ida. Hu Rosh Ha'ida. So, good Hebrew students, who is he? Right. And he is she. Okay, so who is he? So he. Rosh. Now, many of you probably know Rosh. Rosh Hashanah. It literally means head. But it also means chief, or the most important part. It can mean head. In fact, that's how most English translations translate this portion of Colossians 1:18, meaning head. But by head, it's not necessarily meaning on a body. That's a nice metaphor. Shaul uses it. We'll tap into it this evening. But by head, meaning the chief part, the most important part, the high-ranking part. So He, in the to be verb is implied. He is head, chief, the most important part. Ha ida. Ha, the Hebrew definite article, the, ida, means body, fellowship, community, congregation. So this gets translated in most English Bibles as referring to Yeshua, as he is the head of the church. But literally, he is the chief part, the most important part of the congregation, the assembly. And we're going to come back to this word, Edah, a little bit later and see how it's handled with the Septuagint, that Greek translation of the Old Testament, therefore telling us how our Greek apostolic writings handle it. So very important word, very important concept. So, Hu Rosh Ha'edah, he is the head, the chief, the most important part of the body, the fellowship, the assembling, the church. Okay, so let's read it together. Hu Rosh Ha'edah. Okay, very good, very good. So let's look a little bit here at Parashat Vayechel. Exodus chapter 35, verse 1, the opening verse of this week's Torah portion, says, Then Moses assembled, Vayachel, Moses assembled all the congregation of the sons of Israel, Bnei Israel. So Moses assembles the congregation of the sons of Israel. Two important words we're going to see here, and that is assembly, coming from Vayachel, and congregation. Okay, so we're going to kind of look at those. So Moses returns from atop Mount Sinai. He's radiating the glory of God at this point. And as soon as he arrives in the camp, Exodus 35, verse 1 happens. He assembles all the congregation of the sons of Israel. By the way, on a calendar, this is the day after Yom Kippur. Okay, you can date that if you want, but I'll go ahead and tell you that, and you can figure out how I knew that. But it is the day after Yom Kippur. The assembling of the congregation is going to help us, that phrase, it's going to help us understand the origin of the word church. Because part of our goal in Torah Tuesday is to get our mindset to be that of first century followers of Yeshua. Guess what word did not exist in their vocabulary? Church. They would have looked at you like, what is that word you are saying? They would have had to get you to help them even say the ch sound, because it wasn't part of their language. Church wasn't there. So where do we get this word church? And we're going to see it probably is different than what we think. So many theologies, so many different denominations, and so many divisions have been based on the word church and the concept of what the church is. And so tonight we're going to explore the word church from a first century Jewish or Hebraic perspective. And Exodus 35, verse 1 is going to be our launching pad. But we're also going to use our toolbox and things like verbal tallies and looking at how the Septuagint handled it. All the tools we've been acquiring throughout the years, and we're going to see what is this thing we call the church. So Parashat Vayechel, again, is named after that first Hebrew word of Exodus 35, verse 1. The first word in Hebrew, anyway, is Vayechel. It literally means, and he assembled, and Moses is the he of that. The root of the verb is the simple word kahal. And I believe I put that on your sheet for you. Kahal. Technically, it should have a Q to transliterate it, but most people would go quahal, so I'm kind of cheating by putting a K there. But kahal, and it simply means to assemble. Okay, that's its root. It simply is the word kahal, to assemble. The Hebrew scriptures often refer to the people participating in the tabernacle and then eventually in the temple system as the Kohal, the assembly. The assembly of Israel is a common biblical phrase denoting all of Israel. In its noun form, the word Kohal typically passes into the Greek Septuagint. And again, it's important. What is the Septuagint? It's that Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures that came about quite some time before the time of Yeshua and the apostles. The rabbis realized that there were a lot of Jews living in diaspora, that is, living outside of the Holy Land. And as a result, as more and more generations were being born in cultures that didn't speak Hebrew, guess who didn't speak Hebrew anymore? A lot of Jewish people, right? Living in Greece and Italy and so forth. They didn't speak it, or they didn't speak it well, but they spoke Greek. And so the rabbi said, well, we need to get a translation of the Torah for them. And so 72 rabbis translate it separately. And they come together and they compare their translations, and all 72 of them are exactly the same. And so they took that as a sign from heaven that the translation was inspired, that it was divine, that it had God's stamp of approval on it. And 70 in Hebrew means it's Septuagint, coming from that. And so they called it the Septuagint. Why it's important for us is because the writings of the apostles in our Gospels are written in Greek, or at least the majority of the manuscripts we have. And so we look at the Septuagint to see the vocabulary of what the Hebrew terms or what the biblical terms in the Torah and the prophets are, so that that way we know when the apostles and the gospel writers and so forth are using those words. And so, Kohal comes across in the Septuagint as ecclesia. And I have that on your sheet for you. Ecclesia is a common term throughout the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. It is generally used when it is speaking of the assembly in the tabernacle or the temple, or the assembling of all of Israel as a nation. Ecclesia. What kind of word does it sound like we get in English from ecclesia? Ecclesiastical, right? And that's because we do get it from that, okay? But when ecclesia, which in the Septuagint is always translating kohal, meaning assembly, so you would think, okay, we're going to be fair with our translations. We translate this word as assembly in the first 39 books of the Bible. Let's translate it as assembly in the next 27 books of the Bible, right? Unless you're wanting them to think there is a difference between these two, 39 and 27. Then you translate ecclesia as church. Okay, ecclesia often gets translated, or almost exclusively gets translated as church in English New Testaments. Okay, so imagine every time you are reading your Hebrew Scriptures, the first 39 books of the Bible, wherever it says assembly, say church. So Exodus 35 verse 1. And Moses assembled the church of the sons of Israel. I might change your perspective, because then you'd be like, hey, they had church back then, right? So it can't kind of mean this institutional hierarchical structure established by Roman imperialists around 300 or 400 AD, because Moses was doing it. Or imagine that church never became part of the canon, the word, and when they came to it in the New Testament, they just translated it as assembly. Okay? So this is, you can begin to see the problem. By translating the same word differently in the Hebrew Scriptures and the Apostolic Scriptures, it gives the impression of separation, as if the church didn't really exist at the time of Moses, that the church is something new, that it happened when Yeshua came along, or it was born in Acts chapter 2. I bet you've been taught that before. That's false. It's false when you know what the word is. You know it was around long before Acts chapter 2. So this is kind of the danger of only knowing the English of your Bible, because then well-intentioned people studying it, if that's all they got, then they don't see church in the Old Testament, but they see it in the New Testament, and they think, well, something must be different. something must have changed about how the people of God are gathered because they're called by a different name now. So the church translation of ecclesia has misled us. Because of the double standard in translation, it appears to most readers that church is something exclusive to the New Testament phenomenon and is disconnected from Genesis through Malachi. By translating ecclesia as church, our English Bibles have made us think that church is something different and distinct from Judaism. The word translated in Exodus 35, verse 1, as congregation, that is the Hebrew word edah, which was part of our Hebrew lesson. Edah is the same word that's typically translated in the Septuagint as synagoge. Now, what in the world could the Greek word synagoge mean? Synagogue. Throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, the two words used for the assembling of God's people, kahal and edah, are used interchangeably. And the Greek Septuagint uses the terms ecclesia and synagoge, also interchangeably. Okay. In the apostolic scriptures, ecclesia seems to refer to an assembly of people, while synagoge refers to the place that they are assembling. So ecclesia is the group of people that are assembling, and synagoge is the place where they are assembling. For example, we know that believers refer to themselves as the ecclesia, but in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 16, Shaul refers to all the synagogues, including the followers of Yeshua and others, with the same word. The meeting places of the early followers of Yeshua were synagogues. And here's where your English translators really pulled a dirty trick on you. In James chapter 2, verse 2, most English translations say something like this. If a man or if a person comes into your assembly. Oh, they translated word assembly. Thank you so very much. You know why? Because guess what the Greek word there is in James 2, verse 2? Synagoge. So imagine if you're reading James and you're reading about the early believers gathering in the synagogue, and if a man comes into your synagogue, well, the translators were like, hey, we don't want these people thinking that the early believers gathered in the synagogue, because then they might ask, well, why don't we call our places synagogues now? Well, where's this church business? So let's just call it assembly. Okay. The English translators chose to translate synagoge as assembly rather than what it really means, synagogue. So again, it seems they don't want you to infer the connection that the earliest followers of Yeshua were meeting in synagogues. But in reality, they were, and that's what they called their assemblies. In Tiberias, a couple of really early synagogues have been found. In fact, they date so early, most archaeologists were convinced that they were just early Jewish synagogues, and it was a great find, until they start finding words like Yeshua written on the floor in mosaic tile, and start seeing symbols of the resurrection in the center of the floor as they're uncovering the mosaic, and then they're realizing, wow, they really did worship in synagogues. Okay, in fact, they built them, and they decorated them to look with the art to reflect their belief in Yeshua as their Messiah, as the one who rose from the dead. But yet it was structured just like a synagogue, where the bema seat was, and where the niche for the Torah scroll was, and where the congregation would sit. Okay? So when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, he assembles the congregation of Israel. We have a shadow here. When Messiah comes, when he comes again, as Mashiach ben David, he will gather together his assembly from the four corners of the world. Why did the believers call themselves the assembly or the ecclesia? It may have to do more with their place of origin than any kind of theology. In the Bible, the worshipers in the tabernacle and the temple are collectively called the assembly. In Greek, that would be the ecclesia. In the book of Acts, the early believers consistently met in the temple courts. They were there on a daily basis, gathering. So it was a natural title for a sect to adopt for themselves, as they continue to assemble in the temple on a daily basis. So, What I'd really like all of this to kind of do for you is just this. Every time you're reading your New Testament and you read the word church, substitute assembly. And everywhere assembly occurs, substitute the word synagogue. Don't you think that would make a difference? Or every time you're reading your Hebrew scriptures and you see the word congregation, say church. And every time you see the word assembly, say synagogue. Now do you see how we have innocently adopted replacement theology? Imagine 1,600 years of having this completely different vocabulary, but in reality is not a different vocabulary. And I think we've talked about this even with names. Your translators in the Old Testament translate Yaakov as Jacob. They translate Yaakov in the New Testament as James. It's the same word in Greek and Hebrew, Yaakovi. But for some reason, it's Jacob in the first 39 books. It's James in the last 27. Again, imagine you're reading through your Old Testament, and you say, Abraham, Isaac, and James. What? That doesn't sound right, right? But it would make you think. I mean, at least be consistent. Or, instead of calling it the Epistle of James, you call it the Epistle of Jacob. Why aren't they consistent? But you see how being intentionally inconsistent with it gives us this impression of a division between the two sets of writings, when in reality, it's not there in the original languages. Okay? Tabernacles, Sabbath, and Sukkot. Exodus chapter 35, verse 4. Moses spoke to the church of the sons of Israel. See, imagine if it just said that, right? Moses spoke to the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded." So Moses gave Israel the commandments for the tabernacle. The tabernacle, in many ways, is likened to what is known as a sukkah. S-U-K-K-A-H. Sukkah is the Hebrew word for a temporary hut, a temporary booth, an outdoor shelter that's kind of there temporarily, a tent, if you will. The plural form of sukkah is sukkot, S-U-K-K-O-T. And sukkot is one of the names of the seven festivals of our Lord that's listed in Leviticus. It's often translated as the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot. It just depends on your translator's mood, okay, what he comes up with. But it's the festival in which Israel is commanded to live outdoors for a week in a temporary booth. Leviticus 23, beginning in verse 42. "You shall live in booths," literally Sukkot, "for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths," Sukkot, "so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths," Sukkot, "when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." Other words, it was a powerful way, an incarnational way, a sacramental way to teach every generation about the Exodus and about the wilderness experience and about living out in the wilderness and living only by God's providence, and as a reminder that we are but strangers in this world, and so we are looking forward to the Olam Haba, the world to come. This is also the word Yochanan, John, plays with in John chapter 1, in verse 14, when it says, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us." It literally is kind of a made-up word, taking this Hebrew word. It literally is, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled," or sukkoted, or took temporary residence among us. In other words, John is tying the Messiah's body to a sukkah, that this is where God kind of temporarily dwelt among men for a while, was in the person of Messiah. In many translations, as I said, the Feast of Booths is often called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Festival of Tabernacles, because again, a tabernacle is a temporary structure. That was the whole point of the tabernacle system, right? They were wandering through the wilderness. It was kind of like the MASH unit of worship centers, right? What's a MASH unit? Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. You had to be ready to take it down and put it on the go and set it back up and ready to roll again. And so that's what a tabernacle was. It was this temporary dwelling place. And so God had Israel camping out, as it were, in tents while they were wandering through the wilderness. The temporary structures they lived in were called the Sukkot. God then had them build a tent for him to camp in. That is the tabernacle. That is his sukkah. The tabernacle is God's sukkah in the wilderness. Okay? It's his temporary dwelling place so that he might dwell with, among, and in his people. This is why the wise King Solomon, when he built the first temple, and you're reading now in the book of Kings and Chronicles, but when he builds the first temple and he has the big day, the grand opening, what day is it? It's the festival of Sukkot. That's why he chooses it. Now you know why he chooses it. Solomon understood that by taking up residence in a physical building, God was, so to speak, camping out among them in his sukkah. The festival of Sukkot is also the seventh of the seven festivals. Therefore, it's like the Sabbath of the biblical festivals. Just as the Sabbath is the seventh day of the week, Sukkot is the seventh festival of the year. It's the culmination and the completion of the annual festival cycle. And so if all of the festivals are foreshadowing and fractaling and predicting and describing and discussing Messiah among us, when will be the grand culmination of everything Messiah will do? The fall festival of Sukkot. Which ones has he already kind of taken care of? Though that's an oversimplification, but we'll go with it for now. He's handled the spring ones, right? Especially Passover and unleavened bread and first fruits and Pentecost. But what hasn't he handled fully yet? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. First coming, second coming. Messiah, son of Joseph, Messiah, son of David. The suffering servant, the righteous king. Okay, the festivals divide themselves up that way. Also, the Sabbath in the week, what's it a foreshadow of? It's a foreshadow of the Messianic age and the Olam Haba, where everything is joyful and peaceful and God's presence dwelling in its fullness. And so like the Sabbath day, Sukkot is a celebration of the Messianic kingdom on earth. It looks forward to that day when the Messiah will reign and rule out of Jerusalem, and each person will sit under his or her own vine and fig tree, which symbolizes in the prophets an era of peace and prosperity, when wolf lies down with lamb and the Torah goes forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. In that day, the prophets, such as Zechariah, say that all the nations, Sukkot is the one festival that specifically mentions all nations, every person on the planet Earth, one day observing as they summon to Jerusalem to celebrate this festival. So it's the festival of the nations. It's this feast of great joy for all the nations of the earth. And they will go to the temple in Jerusalem, to the Sukkah of God. Isaiah talks about nations streaming to it. The sukkah will give them shade from the heat by day, refuge and protection from the storm and the rain by night. And like the festival of Sukkot, the seventh-day Sabbath also anticipates the Sabbath rest of God's redemptive cycle. That each day of the week corresponds to an age, a thousand-year period, if you will, of history culminating in the thousand-year Sabbath, in the thousand-year reign of the Messiah, the Messianic age. So, think of among the many ways I've given you to think of tabernacle and temple, another one is, it's God's sukkah. And this is important when you're reading through the Gospels, especially in Yohanan, the Gospel of John. Because John is trying to really argue the point that the physical sukkah of God on earth has become so corrupted. And this is why Yeshua goes there and he turns over tables and he's constantly just clanging with those from Judea, those from Jerusalem. The Essenes share this same view, that it was so corrupted that God could no longer dwell there. And John's point is, God hasn't abandoned living in and with and among his people. There's still a temple. There's still a tabernacle. There's still a temporary dwelling place, a temporary tent for God to dwell among humanity. And for John, that is the Messiah. Right? Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I will build it again. Throughout the Gospel of John, you have that temple, tabernacle metaphor being tied to the work of the Messiah. Making the tabernacle. Exodus 35, verse 21. Everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting, and for all its service, and for the holy garments. In other words, as they heard Moses speak these powerful words of God from Mount Sinai about building this temporary place for God to dwell in his people, for heaven and earth to kiss. Remember, that's another way to think of the tabernacle, that it's the portal that unites heaven and earth, the world above and the world below, that it's that supra-meta-reality, where these two things, kind of these two realities, these different dimensions coexist, the whole system designed so that the things below can be drawn to the things above. And it's saying, after hearing this, those who had their hearts stirred and those who had their spirits moved contributed to making sure this would happen. They contributed to the work, getting the tent of meeting ready and getting things ready for the service and for making the garments that were going to be necessary for this. So when Moses comes down from the mountain, he commands the assembly of Israel, or the ecclesia of Israel, to start building the tabernacle. And here we're provided with a shadow, again informing us about Messiah and when he comes. That is, he will come with the instructions and the guidelines to rebuild what has once been torn down. He will come to rebuild this grand portal for the nations to stream to connect to God. This again is Zechariah stuff, where, and on that day, he and his name will be one, and all nations will acknowledge him, and so forth. Very powerful prayer in the prayer service called the Eleinu, which we've looked at before, that discusses this day of this grand Sukkot, when all the nations when the veil is removed from their eyes, and they realize all the idolatry and all the paganism and all the things that they pursued and trying to reach God or reach the things above, that in reality they were trying to reach this God, this one God, this one true God. And Jerusalem becomes the portal, and so all nations stream to it. That's what Messiah brings. That's what Moses was bringing. The assembly of Messiah, also known as the ecclesia, or the church, is metaphorically also spoken of as the temple. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19, Shaul reminds us that even as individuals, we are to function as the holy temple of God. That is, even as individuals, we are to be kind of tiny sukkah that bring with it divine presence, divine goodness, divine favor, divine love, divine compassion. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, he says that corporately, we are the temple of the living God. One quote I particularly like from a Jewish mystic described it this way. The Holy One, that is the Tzaddik, cleaves constantly to God. Behold, a person like this, he himself is to be considered the tabernacle, the temple, even the altar. And also it is said regarding this Tzaddik, this righteous one, that because the Shekinah dwells in him just as it did in the temple. What better description can we have of Yeshua? This is exactly the Gospel of John's motif. It's also a good description of followers of Yeshua who form his body. In his first coming, Yeshua came with the instructions for this metaphorical temple that we call the body of Messiah, or the body of Christ, but we use Messiah. And he establishes the temple of the Ecclesia. So remember this, though. Moses did not build the tabernacle. Moses did not build the tabernacle. Solomon did not build the temple. Moses brought down the instructions, but the people did the building. This gives us a shadow, and the shadow is also an important lesson for us because it teaches us as the assembly of Messiah that it is created, that is the ecclesia, the church, the edah, is created by the individuals within it. Just as the Israelites labor to make the various components of the tabernacle, we labor together to create the assembly of the Messiah on earth. In other words, the responsibility falls upon us. And unless we contribute to the project, and unless we set our hands to the task, the work does not get done. In other words, which is what the church has largely done, as it's grown fat, happy, and lazy, is it's decided to just kind of sit around and wait for the Messiah to come. The whole idea of Jesus has done it all. So we're just going to kind of hang around until he comes back again and fixes everything and sets everything in order, makes everything perfect. The problem with that is, if you understand Scripture as a fractal, which is what we've been working on for 3 years, it doesn't fit the pattern. It doesn't fit the pattern. What's the pattern? That he would come with the instructions and the method and the teaching and the portal and the way. But ultimately, you got to do it. And so as long as we're fat, happy, and lazy, it's going to be generation after generation after generation waiting. The kingdom comes when we bring the kingdom, when we live as if the kingdom is here. That was the gospel message, the original gospel message. Turn around. Wake up. The kingdom is not on its way. The kingdom is here. Live it. Live life upside down. Okay? Sermon on the Mount. Part of the instruction manual for how to do this. Okay? Moses didn't build the tabernacle. Solomon, the messianic shadow, didn't build the temple. Messiah won't build his body either. Moses gave the instructions. He gave the connecting points. Just as Messiah has come, and he's given us the connecting points. He's given us the portal, namely himself. But if we don't plug into it, we never get the juice. So the Israelites all brought different gifts as they were able, labored in different departments, gave of their different talents, to complete the tabernacle. In the same way, we all have different roles and functions within the assembly, the ecclesia, the synagogue of Messiah. In 1 Corinthians 12, the Apostle Shaul turns to the body of Messiah metaphor to explain this concept. He points out that a human body is comprised of many parts. One believer may be likened to a foot, another to a hand, another to an ear, still another to an eye. The body is healthy and functioning and only achieving what it wants to achieve and needs to achieve when all the various parts are functioning in their God-given roles. And so as long as we have a hand saying, I know I'm a hand, but I don't really have to do anything because I'm a hand that's saved by grace, so I'm just going to sit over here. You know, we'll let the foot take care of that, or we'll wait until it just kind of happens. Well, the whole body suffers. The whole body is weak. And imagine you've got a hand doing that, and a foot doing that, and a leg doing that, and the eyes doing that, all just kind of sitting around, not actually grabbing, turning, seeing, hearing, smelling, but just all kind of just being idle. Okay. The pattern is the parts of the puzzle, the members of the body, are active. They're doing things. Shaul further employs the metaphor to illustrate how ridiculous it is for some parts of the body to either be envious of other parts or to try to be other parts. Though the body is composed of different kinds of people, he says Jew or Greek, slave or free, just as the different members bring different gifts to the body, we are all one in Messiah. There are a variety of ministries, he says, but the same Lord, 1 Corinthians 12:5. So Shaul is illustrating the mutual dependency of the body parts on one another. He says, 1 Corinthians 12, beginning of verse 18, "But now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body, just as he has desired. If they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but still one body." The same principle is derived from the accounts of making the tabernacle. Paul is using the same understanding of how the tabernacle, which is the shadow of the body of Messiah, because now how does the presence of God, how is God dwelling among his people now in this world? The temple's not there, the tabernacle's not there, Messiah in the flesh, John 1:14, he's not here. How is he doing it? Through his body, the body of the Messiah, the ecclesia. The church is now the incarnation of God in this world. And so everything that the tabernacle system did, that the temple system did, that Yeshua did, now that's the church's function. Wow, I mean, that's a big deal. And this is what Paul is pulling from. Some people contributed gold, some silver, some stone, some fabrics. Some were skilled in weaving, some in casting stone, some in embroidery, some in gem setting, some in woodworking. But only by combining all of the talents and gifts could they be successful and create the tabernacle. Only when we work together as a unit, not my church versus your church, my denomination versus your denomination, my dogma versus your dogma, my creed versus your creed, your heresy versus my truth, all of that severs the body. And it never sits back and realizes, you know, while that kind of worship would drive me nuts down the street, or while that kind of understanding of reality I can't quite get on board with, you know what? They're doing things in the community that our congregation won't touch. Our congregation would never leave its doors open 24/7. Our congregation would never just let anybody and anybody come and sleep on our pews. Never! Well, that's why you need that congregation down there doing it. And only when we understand it's all supposed to work together, ebb and flow, that the body of Messiah becomes incarnational and God begins to dwell in, with, and among his people through his body, the body of Messiah. The body of Messiah in its fullness was manifested in Yeshua, but now the body of Yeshua is the body of Messiah, the ecclesia, the assembly, the congregation. The mystical concept of the body of Messiah is echoed throughout the Jewish writings that speak of the whole assembly of God's people as one single interrelated body. In other words, what Shaul was talking about in Corinthians, 1 and 2 Corinthians, it's not original to him. It predates him. It was volumes before he ever was born about this concept of the body of Messiah working in and through people as one unit. In the body of Messiah metaphor, Yeshua is likened to the head. But not just the head, but Rosh, the chief part, the most important part, the brain, right? Shaul says Messiah, as our Hebrew lesson did, is the head of the body, the ecclesia. He reminds us to hold fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by joints and ligaments, grows with the growth that is from God. In Ephesians 2, Shaul returns back to the tabernacle metaphor, speaks of believers being built together into a holy temple. In this metaphor of Shaul, Yeshua is the cornerstone, which in building would be the most important stone, right? On which the structure is built, and the work of the apostles and the prophets, mainly for us that would be the scriptures, provides the foundation. Ephesians 2, beginning in verse 20. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Messiah Yeshua himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together into the dwelling of God in the Spirit. You can even think of it now as our knowledge of science and so forth has expanded. You know, Shaul is using fingers, hands, eyes, ears, head. Think about it now even on a cellular level, right? That even within your body, you have cells, certain cells, just to carry certain enzymes or certain messages. But yet within the cell is an entire universe of its own, functioning just like the universe outside of it. So it just keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. The smaller you go, in reality, the more complex it gets, irreducible complexity, which according to Darwin, that's not supposed to happen. But somehow it does. But the message for us is this: get busy. The kingdom comes, the tabernacle is built when we bring it, when we function as a body and we bring it. Proverbs 31, Eshet Kail, the excellent wife. In the body of Messiah illustration, talking about this idea of the body of Messiah, where Yeshua is the head, Shaul lets the body of Messiah concept also inform a second metaphor that he frequently uses. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 23, he says, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Messiah is also head of the ecclesia, he himself being the Savior of the body." In this passage, he directs us to think of believers as the bride of Messiah. So now he's shifting the metaphor a little bit from being the body of Messiah to being the bride of Messiah. And just as a husband is head of his wife, Yeshua, head of the body of Messiah, he, the husband, the bride of Messiah, he is the husband of the bride of the Messiah. This ties together because in Torah practice, if you've ever been to a Shabbat meal on Friday evening, the man of the house is supposed to honor his wife on Friday evenings by reading the words of Proverbs chapter 31, verses 10 through 31. Sometimes we will have our son read that, or split it between the son and the daughter as they compete who gets to read. But it's to pay honor to the wife who has actually made the Sabbath happen. She is the one that's made sure everything is ready. That's part of her holy task and part of passing on that to her children and all of that. And so the man honors her by reading Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31, known as Eshet Kail, which in Hebrew means the excellent wife. Now often when I read that, I remind people that Proverbs is written on the Remez level, or the Remez level, which means it not only means what it says and says what it means, and it's not only honoring the excellent wife, but it's alluding to something deeper. Okay? And so briefly tonight, I'm going to show you how the excellent wife uses images from the tabernacle, as well as images that tie to the Messiah. And so when you're reading that on the Shabbat, you're not only honoring the woman of the house, but you're honoring or you're celebrating the work of Messiah as the tabernacle among us. Okay, so it's a very messianic passage. It's really deep. This is very brief. It's only little things to make you go, and for you to dig into and unpack on your own. Otherwise, we'd be here for a lot longer. So we're just going to briefly go through little portions of it. Again, to show you its connection, Proverbs 31, so many people are familiar with it, especially on Mother's Day. It's on every Mother's Day card and all of that good stuff, and appropriately so. But now you'll be able to begin to think, hey, you know what? This has ties to the tabernacle. This has ties to Messiah. Okay. Far above jewels. Proverbs 31, verse 10. An excellent wife, that is, eshet kayil, who can find? For her worth is far above jewels. Okay, using our verbal tallies. In the construction of the tabernacle, the people readily gave over their treasures and their precious jewels. The tabernacle was worth more than their treasures. The excellent wife, or the woman of valor, is describing the bride of Messiah. She is worth far more than pearls and precious stones and jewels, because she has been purchased by the martyrdom of Yeshua. And so it's there, the excellent wife, on the Remez level, is the bride of Messiah, the ecclesia, the church. Okay? Why is she worth far above anything? Because of the price that was paid to redeem her. Okay, so you begin to get redemption themes. Verses 11 and 12, the heart of her husband trusts in her. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. The tabernacle is a place for carrying out the commandments and for connecting to God. Remember, the Hebrew word for sacrifice is korban, and it doesn't really mean sacrifice the way we think of cutting an animal and having blood going everywhere. Korban literally means to draw close. So the sacrificial system was actually indicating a drawing close of the physical to the spiritual. So the tabernacle was this place to draw things below that needed purification. Remember, the tabernacle was all about purification. Taking things that needed purification, making them pure, drawing them close to their God. The tabernacle and the temple was a gigantic portal that connected heaven and earth. Just as Messiah, the temple not made with hands, is the way to the Father. Without a tabernacle or a temple system, many of the Torah's connections could not be fulfilled. So it's a place for doing good and for connecting to God. So long as the tabernacle or the temple was standing all the days of her life, these good commandments and connections could be fulfilled. Similarly, the bride of Messiah, it too, is a source of good deeds and should not be a source of evil. Messiah exhorts us to repent from evil and to do good. And as long as we connect to the Messiah, we find that these commandments and connections that otherwise could never be fulfilled are indeed fulfilled by our connecting to Him and are done through Him. Wool and linen, verses 13 and 14. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. That's clear tabernacle imagery. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. In the construction of the tabernacle, the people sought out wool and linen to weave together to make the sacred veils and the tapestry and the high priest's garments that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The women worked the wool and the linen with delight. Exodus 35, verse 25. All the skilled women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet wool and in fine linen from flax. Moreover, the people who ascended to the sanctuary on their annual pilgrimage could be likened to those merchant ships, carrying with them their first fruits, sacrifices, and goods for presentation in the temple. Verses 14 and 15, she brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. In the tabernacle and the temple, the priesthood rose before dawn in order to begin the sacrificial system. The whole household of the priesthood ate from the sacrifices that were brought to the altar, and even the maidens of the priest's family had a share in the priesthood's portions. In the body of Messiah, we ought to start our day in the same way, in prayer and in service and in imitation of our Messiah. Furthermore, everyone is satiated at the same table. Hebrews 13, verse 10. We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. So you began, hopefully, to see as a couple weeks ago when we talked about Hebrews and how to properly understand it with that above and below concept, that Hebrews has this Yochanan theme, that the tabernacle, the one not made with hands, is the Messiah. Verse 16, she considers a field and buys it, and from her earnings she plants a vineyard. Okay. Hopefully you can pull from things from other classes. Vineyard. Vineyard always is going to, when you're talking Remez, is going to be hinting at people of God and so forth. So always pay attention to the vocabulary. The woman of valor bought property and develops it. In the days of King David, the tabernacle, or the temple, was in need of a permanent resting place. Remember, that was David's desire. He thought, hey, it's not fitting. I have this palace, I have this place to stay, and my God has to kind of roam around, and he's got no permanent dwelling place. And so he wanted a permanent resting place. And so King David bought the field and threshing floor from Araunah, a Gentile, a righteous Gentile, as the building site for the temple. When the righteous Gentile said, look, I believe in your God. You don't have to buy this. I will donate it. David replies to him in 2 Samuel verse 24, no, I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings. In other words, I will not connect to my God when it costs me nothing. That's powerful words, right? Here's your spot. It's yours. Your God is my God. Notice again the importance of the nations and the building of the temple and all of that. Your God is my God. You can have it. I'm not going to connect to my God when it costs me nothing. So much for cheap grace, folks. Similarly, the son of David, the greater son of David, has paid the purchase price for his people. On the field, the woman of valor plants a vineyard. Israel and the people of God are metaphorically always connected as the vineyard of God. 17 and 18, her reward is good. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. Very powerful tabernacle and temple image there, because one of the names for the temple system, I think I've told you before, it was called the light of the world. Even research the windows in the temple. Have we done that before in the previous year? Most of the time the windows were designed to go structured a certain way to let all the light possible in. They didn't have overhead lights, right? So it was shaped to trap the outside light and funnel it in to get as much light in the building as possible. But the temple windows were the exact opposite, meaning it was the light that was radiating to fill the world. And so it was the light of the world, the light that never went out. Obviously, Yochanan in the book of Revelation pulls from this. We need no sun or moon, right? We need no light, for the Lamb is the light. So the tabernacle was girded with strength in its beams and its planks, those cedars of Lebanon. The menorah of the tabernacle, the menorah is another powerful symbol for Messiah, by the way. More specifically, Metatron and Memtet. The menorah of the tabernacle burned through the night. The bride of Messiah is girded in the strength of the armor of God. She senses that her reward is good, and so her lamp does not go out at night. Instead, she lets her light shine so that all may see her good deeds and praise her God. Stretching out her hands, 19 and 20. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands grasp the spindle. Again, temple, tabernacle imagery. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. Those who donated their time to the construction of the tabernacle, stretching their hands to the distaff and grasping the spindle, did so out of the desire of their willing and generous hearts. The bride of the Messiah, therefore, is to be known for her generosity, for caring for the poor and looking to the needs of the underprivileged. Scarlet, linen, and purple. I should take us back a couple of weeks ago, right, to when we were in the garments for the priesthood and all of that. That's coming straight from there. verses 21 and 22. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. So you might want to go back and review the symbolism invested in the color of scarlet that we talked about. She makes covering for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. We talked about the color purple. The mixture of scarlet and purple wool and fine linen is alluding to the coverings of the tabernacle and the garments of the high priest. So too the bride of Messiah is clothed in the scarlet of Messiah's cleansing blood. Remember, scarlet was associated with the cleansing process. The purple of his royalty and the fine linen symbolizing his purity and his eternal priesthood. When girded in such garments, she has no anxiety for her household. The king in the gates, verses 23 through 24. Her husband is known in the gates, meaning he was on the Beit Din. When he sits among the elders of the land, she makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. In the days of the temple, the king of Israel would actually sit in the city gate, judging and ruling among the people. During the construction of the tabernacle, the people made linen garments and belts for the priesthood. And the bride of Messiah publishes the gospel to the nations, exporting it, as it were, the holy priesthood of believers to all people. Her husband is the Messiah king who sits in the gates of Jerusalem, presiding over Israel and the nations. The last day, verse 25, strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the last day. Here's a little bit of translation stuff for you. Just as the virtuous wife is clothed in strength and dignity, the tabernacle was similarly adorned in the glory of God. The NASB English translation translates Proverbs 31, verse 25 to read, she smiles at the future. But the Hebrew literally says she laughs at the last day. Now, you got to say, look, last day is kind of a verbal tally kind of word, don't you think? And so, last day doesn't mean future, right? I mean, last day means the day Messiah comes in his fullness. So, it's not she smiles at the future, she laughs. She has joy on this last day. So, though the future of the tabernacle and the temple would contain trouble and exile, in the last day she will be filled with laughter, with joy, because she will be rebuilt and restored. The bride of Messiah is clothed in the strength and the dignity of Messiah, and she can laugh at the last day. Psalm 126, verse 2. Then our mouth was filled with laughter, and our tongue with joyful shouting. Another translation clarification, verse 26. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the Torah of kindness is on her tongue. The NASB translates it to read, the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. But wouldn't it be great if they translated the Hebrew word Torah as Torah? Wow, imagine that. That would be so helpful. So the teaching of kindness, literally the Torah of chesed, is on her tongue. The word there for kindness, chesed, we've talked about a lot. Means it's very pregnant with meaning. It means kindness, grace, mercy. It means giving, but giving without boundaries, meaning I'm giving and I don't ever expect anything in return. I'm giving without asking for anything in return. I'm giving not expecting anything in return. Almost giving to one's almost a negative sense of giving because it's so unbounded. Anything without boundaries gets kind of dangerous. That's why you need gavur to kind of put some boundaries around the chesed. That makes it beautiful, which is teferet. But so chesed is just this unrestricted, just pouring out of love. But it also means covenant faithfulness, covenant devotion. And so the tabernacle in the temple was to be a place of Torah, where the scriptures were read and taught, and the bride of Messiah is now the teacher of those scriptures, teaching the Torah, covenant devotion, unrestricted giving. We're to be the bride of Messiah is to be this chesed to the world. The halakha for her household, verse 27. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. The NASB translated, as I read, she looks well to the ways of her household, but the Hebrew literally says the halakha of her household. Now, halakha is a very technical word. On a very concrete level, it means to walk. Okay? But it is the term used for how one keeps the Torah. How does one walk out the life? That's the halakha. So, a lot of translations will say we live by faith. The literal is we walk. We halakha by faith. And so the tabernacle and the temple was the center for this Torah learning. The Sanhedrin decided the halakha for the nation. In other words, they read the scriptures and it says don't do this or do this. And they're kind of saying, well, how does that look like in our life, in our culture, and the ruling that would come down? That's halakha. And so Yeshua gave his disciples, the bride of Messiah, in Matthew 18, this authority to give halakha to the believers. He also warned them not to be lax in their own observance, but to stay diligent until his return. In other words, he expects the bride to follow standard Torah halakha. Her children rise up, verse 28. Her children rise up and bless her. The children of the tabernacle and the temple are the scattered, the diaspora. When Messiah returns, they will rise up from the nations as well as from the dead, and they will offer their blessing and praise. The husband also, verses 28 and 29. And her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Even though she has cried out, I have toiled in vain, I have spent my strength for nothing in vanity, she still has faith in the return of her husband and says, yet surely the justice due to me is with the Lord and my reward with my God. And it says, behold, the Lord God will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. And so the Messiah, as he comes for his bride, behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me, to render to every man according to what he has done. And when he comes for her, his bride, he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you have excelled them all. And then we'll close briefly here with the tent of the Father. Just want to talk about Bezalel and Oholiab, the craftsmen. Names are never just names. So some homework for you this week. Really spend some time looking at their names. They're powerful shadows of the Messiah. The apostles use them in their writings. So they come up time and time again. I'm only going to give you a little hint to do the homework, okay? Exodus 36, verse 2. Then Moses called Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him, to come to the work to perform it. So to oversee the craftsmanship of the tabernacle, this grand portal, this way to the Father, the Lord raises up two men of Israel, Bezalel and Oholiab, and he fills them with the Holy Spirit. Bezalel and Oholiab teach us about the Messiah because they are, quote, Exodus 35, verse 31, filled with the Spirit of God in wisdom, chokhmah, in understanding, bina, and in knowledge, da'at. That would form an acronym known as C-H-A-B-A-D, Chabad. Maybe you've heard that acronym before. Now you know where they get it. That these two men are filled with Chabad, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, and all craftsmanship. We have a lot of verbal tallies going on here regarding the Messiah, the chief one for you. Isaiah says the same description for Messiah. Isaiah 11, verse 2. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. So Bezalel and Oholiab have names that are significant to the tabernacle's imagery. Bezalel means in the shadow of God. That's what his name means. Oholiab means the Father's tent. You can see the A-B at the end, or A-V. Avraham, Father. So one's name means in the shadow of God. The other means the Father's tent, the Father's sukkah. The tabernacle was the Father's tent, overshadowed by the cloud of glory that provided a shade by day. But the names Betzel and Oholiab also have messianic significance. Psalm 91, which is a psalm about the Messiah, alludes to their names. In that psalm, Messiah is called this, and I quote, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High, he who dwells in Betzel," and it says that he abides in the shadow of the Almighty. Okay, so it's doing a word play on their two names. "Because the Messiah has made the Lord his refuge and dwelling place, no evil comes near his tent, for his tent is his Father's tent. His body is his Father's tent. He is the shadow of God, and at the time of his conception, the Spirit was overshadowing his mother Miriam." So we've seen, hopefully this evening, just scratching the surface though, the deep connections between the tabernacle and the temple system and the Messiah. If you don't get anything else, get this. When you're reading these portions of the book of Exodus, don't just get discouraged and think you're reading details about a building that was built 3,500 years ago. Retrain your mind to say, I'm actually reading the blueprints for the person, the work, and the ministry of Messiah. That these are the blueprints of getting the temple and the tabernacle and the entire celestial system going on above. All that is God, all that is heaven, all that is above us. You're looking at the blueprints of how to get that from up there to down here. That's what you're reading. It is the blueprint and the math to bring above to below, to collapse a fourth dimension into a three-dimensional reality. That's what you're reading. You're reading the blueprints of bringing heaven to earth. And therefore, it's going to have heavy connections to the incarnation of Yeshua. It's going to have heavy connections to his work, his ministry, his sacrifice, his resurrection, all of that. Those are all the blueprints of getting above to below. That's really what you're reading. The blueprints of how does an infinite God dwell with finite man? How does a holy and perfect God reconcile and dwell in a sinful creation? That's the blueprints for the system. And just like if you walk into a building or a house and you look at it and you're like, yeah, okay, I see how this is structured. You've got some beams going up here, a wall up here. But if you were to pull out the blueprints, you're just like, I don't know about you, whenever I look at a blueprints for a building and someone's like, well, yeah, the door's here and here's some steps. I'm like, those aren't steps. Those are just kind of two flat lines, right? The blueprints look a lot more complicated than kind of the reality around you. Okay, you're looking at the blueprints for bringing God to man. Okay? That's what's going on. All right, let's close with the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai, notein haTorah. Blessed are you, Lord, the giver of the Torah. Amen.